Our show's name pays tribute to the Boer Trekkers of South Africa, who in 1838 soundly defeated 30,000 Zulus on the bank of the Nkomo River, thereafter called Blood River, from the water turning red with the blood of the slain. Miraculously, no Boer Trekker died and only three were wounded. Now, your friend, Eddie Miller, will be your ambassador for tonight's show.
God bless you, dear Blood River Radio folks. I'll tell you what, I'm just going to make a few comments of what we heard. I couldn't imagine the Battle of Franklin. Are people listening to this show? You need to pass the information you're getting on, even if you don't apply for your degree. There's tremendous, incredible, unbelievable sacrifice of our people, our ancestors from the South. Incredible sacrifice they made trying to preserve, trying to create an independent Southland, an independent South. I mean, the battlefield that Gene described just makes your gut just churn, man. And you know, and he was right. They wanted. Sister Nancy said that the war was about the Yankees, the beast in the North. They wanted a strong, centralized government. That's exactly what they got. But one other thing. I don't know if our people know it or not, but there was a Fort Pickett. I don't remember which state it was in, but it was a National Guard training area. Fort Pickett. It's been, but they tore it down. They took the, and Pickett was, I know Gene will, and Nancy will correct me, but I think Pickett was a general. Did Pickett's charge. It's been renamed to, and I forgot, it's some Native American Gene. But Gene, tell us a little bit about the Fort Pickett, if you know about that. That name's been changed.
That was a Army post. Well, they're going to change all of them. Any Army post that was named after a Southerner, they're going to change all the names, like Fort Hood, Texas, Fort Bragg, North Carolina, Fort Benning, Georgia, Fort Rucker, Alabama, Fort A.P. Hill in Virginia, Fort Lee in Virginia. All of these men served in the United States Army. And then when the war came along, they went with their native state. And so to thank them for their service in the United States Army and laying their life online for the good old U.S. of A., they're going to change the name of all these military bases all over. And yes, one has already been changed. Fort Pickett in Virginia is named after George Pickett. He was one of the three division commanders that made the attack against the Federal lines on July the 3rd at the Battle of Gettysburg. And there was Isaac Trimble, George Pickett, and Johnson Pettigrew. But the Richmond papers were, and since he was a Virginian, they started calling it Pickett's Charge, and actually he was just a third of the troops that were in that charge. But yeah, they've already changed that, and I saw that online. They had a big unveiling of the new, I don't know, Mogadishu, Booga Booga, whoever they're naming it for now. Anyway, somebody you've never heard of. And so, you know, that's the whole point, that the idea to name these bases after these Southern officers that had served in the United States Army, or it was the idea that we're all back as one country, and they wanted to recognize the contributions that these Southerners had made to the United States Army before the war came along and before they were officers or leaders in the Confederate Army. And just like the monument at Arlington, that was a reconciliation monument. And Woodrow Wilson spoke at the unveiling of that monument in 1914. And that was a big thing, that we're back together. And these men that fought in the Confederate Army, many of them served in the United States Army in the war with Spain, the Spanish-American War in 1898. So in a way, to honor those people that admitted that we're one nation and we're back and we're going to help the United States, they put up this monument to the Confederates dead that were buried in Arlington Cemetery. So obviously today they don't want to reconciliate with us. They don't want us to be any part of their federal empire, and that's fine. If the Russians and the Chinese communists want to invade the country, good. The Russians haven't torn down any Confederate monuments, and the Chinese haven't come over here and told us we have to change the name of military bases to Jingba Dong, or something, hero in the Chinese Communist Party. So why would anybody want to lay their life on the line, if you're a Southerner, why would you lay your life on the line to defend a government in Washington that hates you?
Well, you know, they say now that it's possible that Arlington may be saved. I got an email today about that.
Well, they're trying as hard as they can to get rid of it. And, you know, the sculpture was a Jewish Confederate cadet at New Market.
You know, somebody is saying that the critical thing that they can use now as an argument is that this removal is anti-Semitic. Yeah, that's what somebody said. That was
Moses
a good argument.
Ezekiel, and he was one of the cadets at VMI that made that charge at the Battle of New Market. Went across called that muddy field, the field of lost shoes, and they literally pulled their shoes off, making that charge up that hill against the Federal artillery battery. So anyway, but I'm sorry, I'm taking time, and you have your letter you wanted to read.
Yeah, I have a letter. I hope I have time to read it all because it's. Well, I have time to read it, but I would like to read it in one go. It's written by Miss Ellen White, and that name will be part of the letter. But in the past, the blacks were referred to as aunt and uncle, and I found that to be true in South Africa. There was a closeness between the blacks and the whites. So this is something that happened at the Battle of Franklin. And it's a very emotional. George Blaine of the 7th Texas Regiment, on the eve of the battle, told his Negro servant that he had a cousin, the wife of Dr. Aaron C. White, living at Spring Hill, 12 miles from Franklin. He wished to be taken to their home if killed or wounded in the battle. He fell, and the servant took him to Spring Hill. The writer was one of the three small children of the home. There were no military honors, no minister to conduct a religious service, and no crowd to follow him to his last resting place. Only three little children looking on in awed silence while their father helped the faithful servant lower the body into the grave and fill in the earth. Uncle Nick was sent on his way with George Blaine's horse and watch, a lock of hair, and later Blaine's sister wrote from Texas that he had reached her safely with these last tokens. She spoke of having her brother's body removed as soon as days of peace came, but she too died, and he was left. Almost 40 years passed when the postmaster at Spring Hill received a letter inquiring for Dr. White or some member of his family. It was from Uncle Nick Blaine, asking about the grave of his master. He wrote after receiving the desired information and sent some pressed cedar to be laid on Master's grave. The grave has never been marked by a stone, but a wild cherry tree sprang up near the spot and grew into a tree. Miss Ellen White.
That really is emotional, and so many of those boys, nobody knows where they were buried. And one addendum to that is that's why so many of these Southern monuments, when the South would start to recover years and years after the war, would put up monuments on the courthouse square, and in the dedication ceremonies that followed the erection of these monuments, they said they were for the boys that never came home, that never made it back to Texas, or from, you know, Louisiana, they were killed somewhere in Virginia, and they never got back down there to Alabama or wherever they were from originally. So,
I think what this should enlighten some of the listeners to, or maybe some of the listeners who've never studied our history, is the loyalty that was shown and the closeness that was shown to those blacks who were raised in white families. There are innumerable stories of white young men who took servants with them who had grown up with them and were basically their same age.
Oh, yeah. They grew up together. And, in that Crown Hill Cemetery in Indianapolis, when I was working the radio circuit, we had an indoor event there at Market Square Arena. And Saturday morning, I would go out to Crown Hill Cemetery. There are 11 big bronze plaques that a police officer in Indianapolis had made and put at that cemetery for the Confederate prisoners of war that died in the concentration camp, Camp Morton in Indianapolis. And some of those names on there are listed as body servants. So these servants stayed with their master in the death camps that the Yankees ran to try to kill off as many Confederate prisoners as they could. They talk about how bad things were in German concentration camps. Well, they weren't any better over here under the Yankee government. How many of them died up there? And they wouldn't leave. They stayed with their master and died in the prisoner of war camp. And they're listed as body servants. It's their name and then body servant. And then you know, there's a white name in 49th Alabama and a white name in 51st Mississippi and so forth on down through there.
Well, they even got black pensions. You know, the blacks, some of the blacks got Confederate pensions.
They did, yep. And to get a pension, you had to be a combat veteran. So infantry, artillery, cavalry, Navy, or Marine Corps. And if you were a teamster or a blacksmith or a cook or nurse or something, that didn't qualify you for a pension. But in order to get a pension, you had to be in one of the combat arms, and it was a two-page form, and you had to have two witnesses to sign it to get a pension. Now, it wasn't much because the South was broke after the war, but the states would provide a pension. Of course, the United States government wouldn't. But the states would provide a pension, just a few dollars a month, but that's all they could get.
Gene, I hear the music. Looks like we got to go to our break. This break in this last hour. Boy, time is sure flying. Be right back, folks.
Small Business Tech Guys is a team of experts ready to assist you with any service relating to growing your business. Our team specializes in information and technology, social media, general consulting, and HR. We thrive on assisting startup entrepreneurs with growing their businesses. If it's small business, it's our cup of tea. To schedule your free discovery call today, consider sbtechguys.com. We keep an eye on tech, so you don't have to. sbtechguys.com.
I'm Pastor Everett Ramsey, pastor of Faith Baptist Church. A congregation of God's covenant people, informed Christians know that we are at the brink of a long-planned one-world government being executed that will not tolerate true Christian faith. There is a way to stop it. Our church has used God's spiritual weapons of warfare many times over the years, and in every case that was properly executed, the Church of Jesus Christ has been delivered. It is called the Court of Divine Justice. David used it many times. Read Psalm 37, Psalm 109. It includes truthful information, repentance, and imprecatory prayers. Blood River Radio is the only radio station I know that supports action based on truth about lies concerning the Confederacy, the Civil Rights Movement, the German people, the true Holocaust, and who the true covenant people of God are, and the sins and failures of the churches, if any of these. This means anything to you, and it should, then please say so with your money, as well as prayers. You may obtain information from us about the Courts of Divine Justice by sending your offering and request to Blood River Radio, and we take none of the money.
Have you ever heard of Loving Liberty Ladies? Well, the Loving Liberty Ladies are here to help you learn our American heritage and the way it affects today's society. The Loving Liberty Ladies also have a discussion guide called Proclaim Liberty. And with this guide, you can start your own group in your hometown. Get yours today on our website at lovingliberty.net. Look for our lesson supplements, too. They're free. To hear all the special offers and to join the fight for freedom and liberty, please go to lovingliberty.net.
Dear Blood River Radio family, you know, we're always throwing out solutions. Here's one solution I got. I hope it doesn't get us in too much trouble. But we were talking about how the people in the South have been so brutalized. And I know Gene has told us about this. The vast majority of the military, especially the Marines and the Army, they get their recruits from the South. And the Yankee government, the Sodom of the Potomac, the United States government, they hate you. They hate Southerners. They hate white people. We need to go around to especially National Guard bases. And we need to have leaflets while it's still legal. And we need to print up some bullet facts. This is one of my solutions. You know, we're always talking about solutions. We need to hand out these leaflets as best we can, educating people with maybe 10 or 12 bullet points about just how corrupt and low down the stinking Yankee government is. You know, just for instance, anybody with one drop of Southern loyalty, they're not going to agree to having Post, having the forts renamed after some Congo coon. You know, they're not going to go for that. You know, and it educate them to all the illegal wars that are going on right now. You know, if you notice, and I'm going to have to shut the hell up. Gene told me when I'm getting to tell you this. Gene told me that Mr. Buddy told him any people that participate in the war never profit from it. The people that profit from the war never participated in it.
That's right.
We need to get this message out to all of our whites. We need to let these people know, and then especially the National Guard, because there's a National Guard army in every town almost. Tell them, here's the leaflet. These people hate you. You're going there. You're going to be cannon fodder. You're going to expose the DU. You're going to get endless vaccinations that can kill you. That've been untested. Just on and on and on. Your country, this so-called country, hates your guts. That's one solution, people. If you can just get it to one soldier, or try. I see them at the park when I run, and I see them. They got their hair cut and all this stuff. So, hey, what are you doing? Well, I'm in ROTC. As soon as I get out, I'm going to the Marines. I'm going to the Navy, et cetera, et cetera. I'll tell them, well, what you really need to do is join the militia. I try to educate them. Anyway, people, that's just one little solution. So I forgot who we're going back to. So anyway, Sister
well,
Nancy,
Eddie,
is it you?
You know, you oh, were talking ahead, about Jim. That, about Southerners being hated and despised by the enemy's government in Washington, but it wasn't all that way. When I was in Vietnam, every fire support base, every Marine base up there in Northern I Corps had at least one or more, usually many, Confederate flags flying from it. I'm sure the North Vietnamese were staring through their telescopes trying to figure out what country is that down there with that red flag with the blue diagonal cross on it. The only place, they didn't prohibit that. They had state flags, Southern state flags, Confederate flags flying from the bases. The only place they would not allow a Confederate flag, and they wouldn't allow any flag, were the fire support bases that were right smack on the DMZ. They didn't have any flags. Because they could be an aiming point. And even the radio antennas, they'd bend them over. So they didn't want anything sticking up over the horizon so that the North Vietnamese in the DMZ could use that as an aiming point when they were firing artillery or rockets out of the demilitarized zone. Yeah, it was demilitarized,
yeah, right.
All right, to us, but it wasn't to them. So they were all over the place, and there was nothing ever said about it. You know, the blacks didn't say anything about it. They figured, okay, that's guys from the South that had that flag. They're fighting right beside us. We're not going to say anything about that. But it certainly changed since the 1960s. The
you got
attitude
that right.
That they have toward us. So, yeah, like I said, if the Russians invaded, I wouldn't lay my life on the line again for this country and the way they've treated the South since that time. So,
hell
you know,
no.
let them get their transgender, you know, soldiers that were women last week, men this week, and then they're going back to women the next month or something like that. Let them see how they can do against the Russian army. Not me.
The Russians have pointed that out. You know, the Russians have actually pointed that out. That they think the Russians, we got to fight against these lacy drawered faggots? Why, hellfire, you know, this is going to be no contest. But you're absolutely right. I know some units that got in a little bit of trouble with Army units for flying the Confederate flag, and there was this rumor going around that some people got in trouble for lighting a cross, but I think that was just what's that word I'm looking for? Propaganda. I don't think that
propaganda.
Really happened,
Gene. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's what happened.
Well,
they
always use that. You know, they think that's all we do is sit around and burn crosses. That's why we all got to, you know, 30 or 40 pieces of cordwood out behind the house, you know, so we can make crosses to burn every night.
Oh, and we're whipping our slaves, too.
Yeah. Oh, of
that's
course,
right.
I always
oh,
yeah, do that.
Of
yeah.
Yeah, I was going to bring up two men. I'm sure you all probably heard about this. They were killed, our Southern ancestors who were killed in World War II. This is how we received no respect. The son of General Simon Bolivar Buckner and the grandson of Nathan Bedford Forrest both were killed in World War II.
Yeah. And they Nathan Bedford Forrest III was a B-17, his Army Air Corps B-17 pilot. They got hit over Germany, and he was staying at the controls of the plane until all the crew could bail out, and he stayed in it too long, and it crashed and killed him. So he, like Forrest, he was taking care of his, like his grandfather, famous grandfather, he was taking care of his men first, and he rode that thing into the ground and crashed and killed him. And then Buckner, when we came back from Vietnam, we were on Okinawa, and we went to that spot there on the Shuri Ridge where Buckner was killed, or close to that. He was killed by artillery fire, where General Buckner was killed. And so, yeah, I've seen that site. So, that was, and the horrible thing about it, that at one of the Army bases in Kansas, and I can't remember which one it was, they had a display of Nathan Bedford Forrest, the O'Reilly. It may have been O'Reilly. Showing the type of uniforms that the pilots wore back then and some memorabilia and things like that. One black complained, and they got rid of the exhibit because it was an exhibit to Nathan. There was an Army general that was killed in the service of his country, and that black probably has never heard a rifle even fired unless he has been on the shooting range or something. And he complained, and they got rid of that for somebody that gave his life for the wonderful United States of America. So that's how screwed up this country is. People that sacrifice for it, if you don't have the right name or you're from the wrong part of the country, they just dump on you and get rid of all that. So, you know, why would we? Why would we lay our life on the line for this?
Yeah.
Our enemy is in Washington, D.C. It's not in Moscow or Beijing. No, that's or Iran, either one.
No.
So, anyway, well, we had talked about.
Go
ahead. I'm sorry, Eddie, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, and Sister Nancy said this about 2 weeks ago. And here's the thing, Gene, they never forget. You just mentioned, like, these honorable, y'all mentioned a lot of honorable men who fought, like, in the Confederacy and then fought, like, Spanish-American War.
Yeah.
The General Nathan Bedford's four sons went down. But they never forget, if you're from the South, that doesn't make a damn. You can walk on water, and that's not going to satisfy these people. They hate Southerners. They hate us. They'll never, they never will let us outlive that fact that we fought. I say we, our ancestors, fought against that rotten, satanic government.
I got one funny story to tell you. We'll squeeze it in before the break. I promise our listeners we're going to get to Fort Pella. When I was going through Marine Corps boot camp and officer candidate school, Major Peterson, that was head of the whole training thing, came by to inspect our platoon. And, we were standing at attention at the end of our rack there. He'd walk down the line and stop and ask somebody a question and go to the next and stop and ask somebody a question, and we're standing at attention. He gets in front of me, and he said, "Why did you join the United States Marine Corps?" And I thought he was emphasizing United States as opposed to the Royal Marines, like in England or the Australian Marines. So I thought he was emphasizing United States. So he said, "Why did you join the United States Marine Corps?" I said, "Sir, because there wasn't a Confederate States Marine Corps to join." And he was kind of shocked. And he said, "Well, where are you from?" I said, "Sir, Tennessee, sir." And he said, "Well, that figures." And he goes on to the next one. So
you
anyway,
told the truth, by God.
Yeah, well, they didn't kick me out. I guess that was during Vietnam. They needed bodies that had a heart rate and were breathing. So they kept.
You got that right.
We were talking about mentioning something about Fort Pillow and Forrest at Fort Pillow. And I don't have to be gone some of the Saturdays in April, and Fort Pillow was on the 12th of April, 1864. And this is one of the propaganda things that they always throw at Forrest. And, they can't mention anything about his military career or what he did after the war or, what a great military strategist he was, and his tactics are still studied in military schools all over the world, although they don't mention who it came from. But they always throw this Fort Pillow propaganda in our face and on the news. So we're going to straighten it out after we come back from the break.
Folks, you heard it from the bitter ender, so hang on to your seats. Be right back.
Exposing corruption. Informing citizens. Pursuing liberty. You're listening to Liberty News Radio.
USA News, I'm Dave Collins. Idaho will now allow execution by firing squad. Governor Brad Little signed the legislation after the state had experienced difficulty in securing drugs needed to carry out lethal injections. Idaho is now the fifth state in the nation to allow death by firing squad. Others include Mississippi, Utah, Oklahoma, and South Carolina. Mississippi's governor declaring a state of emergency after tornadoes killed at least two dozen people in Mississippi and Alabama Friday night. Most of the dead were in Mississippi, with 13 lives lost in the small town of Rolling Fork. Kendrick Johnson says he drove in from out of state to check on his parents who reside in the hard-hit Silver City.
This was something we've never seen in the city like this. It's horrible just to see what I see, and it's horrible.
He went on to say that his parents' home, like many in the area, was destroyed. Silver City and Rolling Fork bore the brunt of the severe weather. The storm's death toll currently stands after more than 20, with many others left injured and homeless. Crowds are building as former President Trump gets set to formally kick off his presidential campaign in Waco, Texas. Organizers expect the event to draw some 15,000 supporters. The weekend rally comes as a grand jury in Manhattan is considering whether Trump used campaign money for an alleged hush money payment to adult film star Stormy Daniels. Kelly Sadler on Newsmax says she doesn't think Trump will be damaged.
I really feel like the grand jury here is questioning the case and how flimsy it is. And they say you can indict a ham sandwich in Manhattan, but I'm not so sure you can indict Donald J. Trump.
Italian authorities are searching for a man who jumped off a three-story building into a canal in Venice. Mayor Luigi Brugnaro took to Twitter to say he would give the man, only identified as a tourist, a certificate of stupidity for the act. This is USA News.
Cashback is not available on gas in New Jersey and Wisconsin.
This is Matt Crowder, live at the gas station on 41st Street, reporting on those skyrocketing gas prices. Excuse me, miss. Are you buying less gas now because of the high prices?
Oh, I never pay full price for gas anymore. I just use the free Upside app that pays you cash back for every gallon of gas you buy.
Wait a minute. Are you saying you actually get paid cash when you buy gas with the Upside app?
Yes, I get real cash back every time I buy gas.
Well, does that actually add up to anything?
I've made around $200.
Wow. Well, there you have it. Stop paying full price for gas. Download the free Upside app and get real cash back every time you buy gas. This is Matt Crowder, Radio News Network. Download the free Upside app now to earn real cash back every time you buy gas. Use promo code SEAT for an extra 25 cents a gallon bonus on your first tank. You can cash out anytime right to your bank, to PayPal, or any gift card for Amazon and other brands. Just download the free Upside app and use promo code SEAT for a 25 cents a gallon bonus on your first tank. That's code SEAT.
Excuse me, Captain. I know this may sound silly, but can you fly?
Nope. Never had a lesson.
Well, dear Blood River Radio family, we're going to go right back to Gene the Bitter Ender. Gene, he keeps tearing these damn sores up. It's really rough on our budget here, so if y'all could... Need to send the Bitter Ender some new sword money, because he keeps just wrecking how these swords. I mean, the Yankees, I mean, man, if a day goes by, he doesn't put a sword on one Yankee. He considers it the day it lost. But anyway, so we need new sword money, folks. We're going back to the Bitter Ender. Go ahead, Bitter Ender.
Well, we were talking about how they insulted all of our Southern officers that served in the United States Army, either prior to the War for Southern Independence or served afterwards. They've taken down anything that had a Southern name, like Nathan Bedford Forrest III, as an Army Air Corps pilot that was killed over Germany, and now they've taken down a display honoring him just simply because of his last name. And the person they go after the most is the original Nathan Bedford Forrest, and they couldn't defeat him on the battlefield, so they crank up all this propaganda, and it still goes on and on and on. And even when you call into the TV station and explain they're wrong, this didn't happen, that didn't happen, they come back the next day and say the same thing over again. They don't want to hear the truth. The three things they always throw at Farce: he was a slave dealer. Okay, yeah, he was, and that was a legal profession, and he took care of the people that he had. He wouldn't break up a family, and he even let his slaves go out and pick the people that they wanted to work for, and then he'd go and talk to the owner and negotiate a price and make the sale. And then they say, well, he started the Ku Klux Klan. No, he didn't. He was living in Memphis. The Klan was started not as a political organization, but just as a soldiers' organization in December of 1865 in Pulaski, Tennessee, which is down south of Nashville, right in Giles County, which is right on the Alabama state line. And he was living in Memphis, so I asked these people, well, if he's in Memphis and it started in Pulaski, how'd he do that? Did he use Spotted Al Gore's internet that he claimed he invented and started on the internet? And there's documentation of that. They used to have a plaque there in Pulaski with the six names of the Confederate soldiers that started it on the law office where it started. And then they've taken that down, but Forrest's name wasn't on that plaque. And like I said, it wasn't a political organization until the Reconstruction got so bad. And then there were a lot of vigilante groups that sprang up to try to protect the people of the South, and especially the women, from the Freedmen's Bureau, the blacks, and the Reconstruction government. And the other thing they throw at him, and we're going to straighten out right here tonight, is he ordered the massacre of the poor Negro troops at Fort Pillow. Well, that didn't happen either. So what happened was that Forrest, after the battle, we back up a few months from April of 1864 to September of 1863, after the Battle of Chickamauga, where Forrest actually opened the battle, his cavalry opened the battle at Reed's Bridge across Chickamauga Creek, and fought on the field there for 3 days, dismounted as infantry. And then when the federal lines broke and they scrambled back up over Missionary Ridge and down into the valley and into Chattanooga, he was up there on that ridge and threw field glasses and captured a federal lookout tower up there. The Confederates got there so fast that the Union soldier up there with his giant telescope couldn't get down off the tower. Forrest ordered him down, and Forrest climbs up there and looks down there in Chattanooga and sees all the disorganization, and he's sending message after message back to Braxton Bragg to bring the army up. They're disorganized. We can finish them off and drive them right into the Tennessee River. Bragg did nothing, and Forrest was absolutely furious that the loss of life they suffered at Chickamauga, the Battle of Chickamauga. And he said, why does Bragg even fight battles? He does nothing with it. Well, Bragg didn't like the criticism, so he transferred him west to the Department of Mississippi, Alabama, shortly after that, in the fall of 1863. So Forrest, and he took his command away from him. So Forrest had to go over there and raise his third command of the war. All he took was his staff, his escort, and a few of his soldiers. So he had to scramble around and get deserters and boys and militia, and he was given two cavalry divisions that were in Mississippi, but one of them was Abraham Buford's. They had no horses. They were dismounted cavalry, so they might as well have been infantry.
Damn.
And so he thought that the reason he was transferred over there, that he knew now that Sherman had Chattanooga, and anybody that could look at the map, he said, well, his next objective is going to be move down the railroad from Chattanooga to Atlanta and take Atlanta. So Forrest thought they were sending him over there to take out the Nashville and Decatur Railroad, from Nashville straight down south to Decatur, and the Nashville and Chattanooga Railroad that ran from Nashville southeast down to Chattanooga. You cut Sherman's supply lines, and he's stuck in Georgia with no reinforcements, no supplies, no medicine, no feed for the soldiers, forage for the horses, anything. So that's why Forrest thought that's why they sent him over there. That wasn't it, but he was such a brilliant strategist, he could look at a map and figure all of that out. So the first thing he needed to do, he needed to get horses for Abraham Buford's division. And he knew that the Yankees had horses in West Tennessee and Western Kentucky. So he was at Columbus, Mississippi, which is up in sort of north central or northeast Mississippi. And on March the 1st, they leave Columbus, headed north into Tennessee. Now, what Forrest did, he sent all his scouts ahead of him. And he knew exactly where the Yankee strong points were, at Memphis, up at Columbus, Kentucky, at Paducah, Kentucky, and everywhere that was fortified by the Yankees in western Tennessee and western Kentucky. Forrest, by this time, was a master of the raid. And he didn't just take off on a joint, headed out somewhere. He knew exactly where he was going. He knew exactly where the bridges were across the rivers. He knew where the fords were across the rivers. He knew where the friendly civilians were, if they needed supplies or horses. He knew exactly where he was going before they ever took that first step out of Columbus. And they did on March the 1st. And in their operational orders, nothing was mentioned about Fort Pillow. That was not a part of their plan. By March the 20th, they were at Jackson, West Tennessee. He left part of his command there to guard supplies and prisoners and wait for Buford, his dismounted men, to catch up. He sent a small detachment down to, quote, attack Memphis and keep the Federals in Memphis bottled up there. And he took Lieutenant Colonel Crew's battalion. He didn't just pick them at random. They were from Memphis in Shelby County. So they knew where their family was, where they could get horses, where they could get food. And so that's why he sent them there. By March the 23rd, they were up at Union City in West Tennessee, and he sent Colonel Duckworth and Colonel Faulkner to capture the Union City. And Colonel Faulkner was interesting. He had a rather famous grandson by the name of William Faulkner that I think was a pretty good writer in his time.
Pretty fair.
So they captured Union City on the 24th. They sent in a command that it was Forrest out there, and he bluffed the Union garrison in Union City to surrendering. By the 6th of March, they were all the way up at Paducah, Kentucky, and they drove the Federals back into the fort and under the cover of a gunboat, and they picked up supplies and horses. They rounded up prisoners, and they burned the cotton on the docks in Paducah because this cotton had been stolen by Yankee speculators that followed the army down here, and they were taking this back to sell and make a lot of money off of Southerners that had grown the cotton. So they burned the cotton, and the Yankee speculators didn't make any money off of that. By April the 4th, they're back at Trenton, Tennessee. And on April the 4th, he sent a detailed report to Stephen D. Lee down in Mississippi, who was his commanding officer. And he kept his commanding officers always informed, and he gave them a report of how many prisoners they'd captured, how many horses they'd captured, miles of railroad they'd torn up, telegraph lines they'd taken out. Once again, they've gone on this raid for 5 weeks, and nothing was mentioned about Fort Pillow. On April the 6th, he sent a supplementary message to Stephen D. Lee and said, "We will attend to Fort Pillow." So the raid is 5 weeks old, and this is the first time that Fort Pillow has been mentioned. And why? Because the civilians in West Tennessee asked Forrest to do something about Fort Pillow. Fort Pillow was built on the Tennessee River. The Mississippi River in West Tennessee. And it was built by the Confederates. Gideon Pillow built it as part of the defenses of Memphis. But early on, when Memphis was attacked, they didn't have enough heavy artillery there to stop the Federal fleet coming down the Mississippi and to attacking Memphis. So it was abandoned, and it was abandoned by the Federals. And it wasn't until later on in the war that they actually put troops there. And all they were doing was going out of Fort Pillow and robbing the people of West Tennessee and attacking the civilians and attacking the women. And when Forrest heard that the women were being attacked, that's it. That sealed the fate of Fort Pillow. He would not stand for women being civilians, and especially women being attacked by the Federal soldiers. And they were the dregs of the U.S. Army. They were Tennessee Tories and deserters from the Confederate Army, about half white, half black, no combat experience. The only officer that Major Booth that had any combat experience at all, he was killed outright in the first round of rifle fire that hit the fort, and the command fell to a Major Bradford that was, even the Federal officer said, was worthless. So anyway, on the morning of April 12th, the Confederates overran the pickets at Fort Pillow, drove them back into the fort, and then they had a ridge that the fort was built right down on a bluff on the Mississippi River, but out about 100 yards, there was a ridge that ran around the perimeter of the fort that was never fortified, and it had been cleared, but there were still stumps and trees laying there. Excellent cover for sharpshooters. So we'll get into the actual battle itself after the break.
I can't wait to hear him make a comment when we come back. Be right back, folks.
The spirit of the American West is alive and well in Range Magazine, the award-winning quarterly devoted to the issues of the American West. Each issue contains informative articles, breathtaking imagery, as well as the culture of cowboy spirit today, and gift ideas, like this year's Buckaroo calendar. Order online from rangemagazine.com. Loving Liberty Network salutes the spirit of the American West at rangemagazine.com.
I'm Monica Schaefer from Canada, a former political prisoner. Here at Blood River Radio, we are not afraid to tell the truth and shame the devil. Our mission is to fight against white genocide. We do that by exposing the lies. We talk about the American Civil War. We talk about the vilification of German people and, by extension, all white people. And we even talk about that linchpin lie, the Holocaust. Deception by the alien enemy within has brought us whites to our knees. My last words at the Schaefer's speech crime trial in Germany were, quote, "If there was a law forbidding us to breathe, we would break that law immediately just to live. And so it is with this law. We must break this law in order to survive and thrive as a people," unquote. Please donate to Blood River Radio and help keep us on the air.
This is a battle between truth and deceit, a battle between forces that would enslave this country in darkness and between a media that wants to present you with the truth.
We are being censored. America's news outlets no longer provide the truth. 90% of news outlets in the United States are controlled by 6 corporations. The mission of the Epoch Times is to chase the truth, to ground all statements in fact.
TheEpochTimes.com.
What we've got here is failure to communicate. Some men you just can't reach.
Well, dear Blood River Radio audience, family, excuse me, we don't have audience, we have family. I can't believe this is the last part of the show. I can't believe almost 3 hours ago. Anyway, we got to go right back to Brother Gene, the bitter ender. Go ahead, Gene.
Well, I'm watching my watch. We're going to let Nancy, make sure Nancy gets back on toward the end of this segment to give you the address. Have pen and paper ready to write down the address so you can get your certificate, your diploma from the Blood River Radio History course here. So we were talking about Forrest Calvert going to Fort Pillow to take care of these murdering thieves that were coming out and attacking the civilians in West Tennessee. Had no military importance at all, but he's going to take care of the civilians. Because, you know, everybody knows Calvary can't attack a fort, and even if he captured it, the Federal Navy could come along and blast him out of there. So, you know, that's why he went, take care of the civilians. So about daylight, they drove in the pickets. The Confederates captured this ridge that ran in a semicircle around the fort, about 100 yards away from the earthworks, the earthen fort down on the bluff right on the Mississippi River. They're firing down into the fort. So for all intents and purposes, the battle's over. The Confederates control the high ground. Any federal soldier that sticks his head up over that earthen wall of the fort is a target, and one of the first people that were killed, took a round right between his running lights, was Major Booth. And now it went to Major Bradford, who even the other Yankee officer said was worthless, and he ducked out of some shenanigans, financial shenanigans, up in the Midwest and joined the Army to hide and get away from the creditors and keep from going to jail. So he was pretty worthless. About 11 a.m., Forrest arrived. He changed some of the locations of his troops, had these snipers up there on the ridge behind stumps and trees that had been cut down, keeping the defenders pinned down. And Major Bradford then ordered the cabins nearest to the fort burned to keep the Confederate soldiers to use, so they couldn't use them for cover and keep up their sniper fire. Now, here's lie number one. The claim was that Forrest burned U.S. wounded alive. Well, that's a lie. If they were burned alive, they were burned by U.S. soldiers that set fire to the cabins, not the Confederates, because they wanted the cabins there. About noon, Forrest increased the snipers, did a personal reconnaissance along the ridge, had 2 horses hit, and his staff officers advised him to dismount. He'd be less of a target. And Forrest told him, "Well, I could get killed on foot, and I can see a lot better when I'm mounted." "Yes, sir. It's your call, General." About 1 p.m., Forrest ordered some of the others to move into the north side of the fort along a Coal Creek ravine and increase the sniper fire. At 3 o'clock, the fort's completely surrounded. Confederates men, snipers along the riverbank drove off a Yankee gunboat, the New Era, that was supposed to protect the fort. But what Forrest would do, every time they'd open these ports to slide a cannon out and shoot, they would send a hail of bullets flying through the open port, ricocheting off the cannon barrels or hitting the gunners. They just closed up and steamed off upriver and got the heck out of there. So he sent in a demand for surrender. The defenders were pinned down, Major Bradford asked for an hour. He was stalling and hoping that reinforcements were coming up from Memphis. Forrest said, "You've got 20 minutes. So during this truce, the blacks who had been given liquor, to boost their courage, and they were drunk because after the Confederates got into the fort, they found kegs of whiskey and gourds all along the wall. So the blacks were pretty well soused, and they stood up on the parapet during the truce and then shouted insults and made obscene gestures at the Confederates. Now, this was the day before the NFL and the NBA, and trash talk didn't go over real well back then. So there was already bad feelings between the Confederates and the white U.S. soldiers that had been robbing their families in West Tennessee, and this didn't help things a lot. So by 3:30, they sent the reply, "We'll not surrender." Their cannons in the fort were loaded with double shot loads of canister. All the weapons were loaded. Extra rifles were placed along the wall. And they gave weapons to the civilian settlers that were along the riverbank that were selling supplies to the troops. Another lie, that Forrest and the Confederates shot the poor unarmed civilians. Well, the fort's poor unarmed civilians were armed, and they were shooting at Confederate soldiers. So Forrest gave his assault orders that rifles and shotguns were loaded and carried, and each soldier carried four pistols. But no shots were to be fired until the assault troops were inside the fort. And the sharpshooters kept the enemy heads down while the Confederates launched their attack. So about 4 p.m., the bugle sounded charge, and 12,000 Confederates raced downhill, jumped into a moat that ran around the fort. So they were down in the moat, and less than 8 feet away, the Yankee soldiers were on the other side of this dirt wall. Luckily, they didn't have hand grenades to pitch over the wall. But if they raised up on that dirt wall and tried to shoot down at the Confederates, the snipers up on their ridge would pick them off. So on the second bugle blast, the Confederates came over the wall. And the Yankees got a blast of shotguns, rifles in the face. They dropped those, and the Confederates weren't standing up. They just came up, scrambled up that dirt bank, and fell right on top of that earth wall, shotguns and rifles in the face, and they whipped out the pistols and started blasting away. This was the original shock and awe right there. The defenders broke and ran across the parade ground, and they were channeled between rows of tents that were there. Oh, now, the white Yankee soldiers got the cabins. The blacks were in tents inside the fort. So when they were channeled in between those tents, they were perfect targets. The Confederates were just sitting on the wall from like 30 yards away. They were blasting away, couldn't miss. So the majority of the casualties took place up there on the parade ground of the fort. They scrambled down a bluff to get to the river because they thought this gunboat was going to save them, but it was gone. And a lot of them fell down the bluff and broke arms or legs. Some of them tried to jump in the river and swim away, or they were shot trying to swim away. So now the Confederates were coming down the river road from the north. They were coming up the river road from the south, and the Confederates had come over on the wall of the fort were now sitting on top of the bluff firing down at this mass of blue soldiers down below. So it wasn't just a crossfire. It was a triple fire that was going on. And about 20 minutes later, Forrest got into the fort, and he ordered the flag, the U.S. flag, cut down. Because as long as the flag was flying, that meant the fort hadn't surrendered. So when the flag was cut down, most of the fighting ended. And most historians agree on it up to that point. It was after that that a lot of the accusations about federal soldiers being shot after they surrendered, that's when that started. And it probably did happen, because down there below the bluff on the river road, it was just absolute mass confusion. And they were taking surrendered soldiers and throwing them back to the rear, getting them out of the way. They'd pick up rifles and start shooting at the Confederates from behind. They'd probably turn around and did shoot them. So anyway, it finally was over, and there were about 261 federal soldiers killed. Most of those were between the tents up on top, where bodies were 2 and 3 deep. About 200 were taken out as prisoners. Now, there was another 130 that were too seriously wounded to be moved, and Forrest left them there with the U.S. medical staff. They didn't take them out. So the statistics were there were 221 Yankees killed. They took out 206 prisoners. 130 were left behind with the federal medical staff. There were 14 Confederates killed and 86 wounded. And then that's why that they said it was such a one-sided battle. Well, the battle was over once the Confederates took that high ground. So the Confederates cleared out of there that night, and they said that Confederates stayed around and robbed the wounded and murdered the wounded. No, there were no Confederates in the fort after that. So the Fort Pillow Massacre then became the big propaganda thing to fire up animosity in the North and help recruiting drives. And they had reports and before Congress. Oh, the eyewitness to the Fort Pillow Massacre was written by a newspaper reporter in Knoxville, a mere 265 miles away from Fort Pillow. That guy had one heck of a pair of eyes and to see all the way across Tennessee. And so they needed some kind of propaganda nonsense to, you know, fire up the Northern press. And the Congress printed 40,000 reports of the Fort Pillow Massacre and sent it out to newspapers all over the North. That was the largest printing up to that time of any congressional report. So the Fort Pillow Massacre was strictly propaganda. I'm not saying that there weren't some soldiers that were shot after they surrendered, because there was bad feelings, and then that melee that was going on down on the river road below the bluff, that was just total confusion going on down there. Confederates coming at them from three sides, and prisoners were picking up rifles and shooting. And I guarantee you, anybody that knows anything about Forrest, if he ordered a massacre, not one single Yankee soldier would have been taken out of there alive.
You
and
got
obviously
that right.
They took over 200 prisoners, so he did. So I'm going to turn it back over to Nancy. Hopefully that will answer some of the propaganda nonsense that we still hear today about Forrest and the Fort Pillow Massacre, not to be confused with the Arlo Guthrie's Alice's Restaurant Massacre. That was probably a real event. So anyway, we'll turn it over to Nancy, and she can give you the address to write in your essay for your Confederate history diploma.
Okay.
Well,
great.
Further corrections, okay. That was the Blood River Radio Division that ordered the complete massacre of every living Yankee soldier. And they got court-martialed because Forrest was more honorable than the Blood River Radio Division. We were mean as hell. But go away, sister Nancy.
Well, this is the last of 5 weeks of Confederate history classes. So in order for you to receive your Blood River Radio degree certificate, please snail mail a one-page essay based on something that was discussed during our Confederate history classes. It must get to us by Saturday, April the 15th. That is 3 weeks from tonight. Professor Jean Andrews will grade your essay, and your degree certificate will be mailed to you by the end of April. So write to Blood River Radio, Post Office Box 34636, Bartlett, Tennessee. That's Bartlett, Tennessee, 38184. And I want to pitch out one thing as we close out. When I visited in Mississippi several years ago, I decided to go through the Vicksburg Cemetery and check out the Confederate section. And in the Confederate section is a Confederate camel, and he is buried under a Confederate marker. Yes, Old Douglas was a member of the 43rd Mississippi Infantry. And I do believe that what happened is when Jefferson Davis was serving under Franklin Pierce, he was a Secretary of War, he ordered camels to be used out in the Southwest. And that was in the 1850s. So I am pretty sure that this camel ended up in Mississippi. Some of them were auctioned off. They were not found to be suitable for the Southwest. I'm pretty sure that this Old Douglas, who became a Confederate, was one of those camels that President Jefferson Davis had ordered when he was Secretary of the War under President Pierce. So it's a fabulous story. And poor old Douglas was killed by a damn Yankee.
Yeah, he was a mascot for that Mississippi regiment. And yeah, Yankee sniper got him. Yeah.
That's typical damn Yankee. You know, and talking about Cold Creek as a kid, I was telling Nancy and Gene during the break, I hunted many a day in that Cold Creek area, crappie fish, squirrel hunted, beautiful deep woods. That's one hell of a steep ridge up there that Gene was telling y'all about.
Well, folks, that's it. That's another Blood River Radio broadcast in the books, and we'll be here same time, same place, April 1st. I think it's April 1st. Yeah, April 1st. So be right, be here, or be square. See y'all, folks. Good night, everybody. Thank you, Gene. Thank you, Nancy. Thank you, Jay.